And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
And it is a good morning to you as we head towards 9:05 on this Wednesday, the 16th of August, 2023. Welcome along to another edition of the 9 till noon show. Our lines are open for you right now, loads lined up for you, hopefully to keep you informed and entertained and engaged for the next 3 hours. But of course, if you wish to raise your own issues, topics, pass on your own stories, let us know what you're thinking. 086 60 25,000, that's the WhatsApp and text. If you're listening from outside the Republic, 00353 86 60 25,000. And more of you texting in from Northern Ireland particularly all the time, which is great to have you on board as well. 07491 25,000 is the telephone number, 00353 7491. 25,000. Start off with some good news, shall we? Because I know many of you out there are dog lovers. We had two beautiful big boxer dogs that were missing yesterday from the Creasla area, and they turned up in the afternoon. So all's well that ends well. Not sure as to what happened to them, whether they were stolen and left back, whether they walked off, wandered off and wandered back, who's to say? But that doesn't matter now at this point, because those two doggies that you would have heard the appeal about yesterday are now back in the loving embrace of their families. Okay, let's look at the newspapers. The Finn Valley Voice this morning tells us that almost 18,950 children in County Donegal will benefit from free school books, workbooks and copybooks from this September. The initiative, introduced by Minister Norma Foley, has made or was made possible through the provision of 1.8 odd million euro worth of funding. Minister for Agriculture, Food and the Marine, Charlie McConnell-Logue, who confirmed the news, said this is a landmark moment for Irish. And then you have to pay, turn to page three, which I don't have. I presume it's students and families or parents. The Inishowen Independent this morning, Buncrana remembers Oma. Buncrana will today mark the 25th anniversary of the Oma bomb, in which three of its sons and two visitors lost their lives. A memorial will be held from 3 p.m. at Nacala Drive in the town, close to the homes that 8-year-old Oran Doherty and 12-year-old Sean McLaughlin left on the morning of the 15th of August 1998, never to return. The boys, along with 12-year-old James Barker and Spanish visitors Fernando Biasco Baselga, 11, and Rocío Abad Ramos, 23, were among 29 people murdered on Market Street in Oma by a car bomb planted by the real IRA. The Inish Times this morning, an issue we're going to be talking about a little later on in the programme. Traders on Buncrana's main street have warned that the removal of the town's half-hour free parking will lead to the closure of businesses. The warning comes amidst a review of the on-street parking in the town, which is being carried out by Donegal County Council. The local authority is building a consultation drop-in to get feedback from businesses, residents and other stakeholders on the operation of on-street parking in Buncrana. It's understood the council is considering doing away with the free half-hour of parking, partly due to an increase in the cost of street cleaning and the fact that on-street parking scheme in the town is running at a loss. Traders say the free half-hour is crucial to much of their business, as it suits customers who only need to make brief stops. Taking it away will reduce trade on the street and the town centre for dozens of businesses, they say. But what do you think out there? We welcome all comments, particularly obviously if you're in and around the Buncrana area. Maybe you're a business on the main street, or maybe you frequent it, or maybe you are frustrated at the lack of parking and you would prefer to see on-street parking charges introduced from DOT, in other words, as soon as you pull into the space. Have your say now. This is part of a consultation, and you know the conversations we have here too are important in that whole process as well. So get in touch with us now. We'll be chatting about it. We'll be chatting about it later. 086 60 25,000, or call us on 07491 25,000. The Donegal Post tells us that Ombord Planala will rule on a major housing development in Bundoran. Donegal County Council had granted conditional planning permission for the development at Church Road in July. McHenry Asset Holdings Limited had sought permission for the construction of 73 new houses on the site. However, local resident Mark Picken has lodged an appeal to Ombord Planala, who will now probe the case. Mr. Picken, in an appeal submitted in late July, argued that the application was initially invalid as the applicant had applied for development on lands that were not within the applicant's control. Subsequently, the applicant submitted new draining with a different site boundary. Mr. Picken pointed out some knock-on effects to an amended proposal, and you can read more about that on the inside of that paper. Right, on to the Irish Times now. An RTE auditor, Deloitte, has been drawn into the controversy over Ryan Tuberty's pay after accountants Grant Thornton examined the firm's role in the affair. Now, the upshot of this report, which will be published later today, is that it will pretty much back up what Ryan Tuberty was saying, that he wasn't overpaid, but actually RTE, for reasons unknown, declared his payments to be under 500,000 euros. So there was a 15, sorry, there was a, let me see, it's 120 in total. There was a 20,000 euro, 50,000 euro, 50,000 euro loyalty bonus, which was due to him. He didn't take it, right? So his salary, or what RTE decided to do for reasons unknown, is they took that money off his salary. So when they published the figures, it made it look like he was earning under 500,000 euro per year, when in fact he earned 505, I think 520 and 520. That's 17, 18 and 19. So he will say, look, this is what I said at the Oireachtas committee. And he'll perhaps feel, not in the public eye, I would argue, but certainly in his own mind, he'll feel somewhat vindicated. But anyway, the RTE board is discussing a new Grant Thornton report, which investigates how the national broadcaster underdeclared Mr. Tuberty's pay by 120,000 between 2017 and 2019. The report is understood to set out that the misleading figures RTE published in 2021 were different from the correct figures recorded on RTE's payroll system. This reflected a decision to not include a total of 120,000 euro from Mr. Tuberty's declared earnings after he waived a 120 euro termination fee due in 2020 at the end of his contract. RTE's position was that Mr. Tuberty's unpaid end of contract fee could be set off against his actual pay because his outgoing contract said the 120,000 euro be waived, including services additional to his radio and Late Late Show work, which were not provided. There's still plenty in there for the Oireachtas committees to get their teeth into, but as I say, it questions as to who made the decision within RTE to underdeclare his income, and also still questions to be asked as to why, although he did address it, why he didn't say, hold on, yeah, I got paid more than you've told the public or you've told the Dáil if you've set out publicly. But anyway, he said that was a mistake. We shall know shortly, this is according to the Irish Independent, the makeup of Donegal ahead of the next general election, because the new constituency boundaries and the number of seats in each for the 34th Dáil will be announced in 2 weeks' time. The Electoral Commission, which has been given the responsibility of redrawing boundaries, has confirmed that the results of its deliberations will be made public on August 30th, with potentially huge implications for the future careers of serving politicians. There will also be a number set for the total number of seats in the next chamber, which is sure to swell by several extra TD berths because of recent population increases. So there is speculation as to what the future might hold for Donegal as a whole, as a two-seater, or how it might pan out. Will it be reunited? Will South Donegal be reunited with the rest of South Donegal? So we're going to know in a couple of weeks anyway. And there will be some, I would argue particularly Fianna Fáil, we'll be keeping a really close eye on that. There's certain people that were elected politicians before that I wouldn't be surprised if we saw them emerge on the scene again, all dependent on how things pan out there. Right, there's a lot of people are going to be in bother today because there was a problem with Bank of Ireland, and it was put out on social media that you could withdraw or transfer money you didn't have effectively. So if you were at 0000 on your bank account with Bank of Ireland, theoretically you could log on to the app and transfer it 1,000 euro to Revolut, or you could have withdrawn it from ATMs. Now, there was a big rush on ATMs yesterday. One thing that happened, which I thought really quite peculiar, is Gardaí was standing at ATMs. What is the role of An Garda Síochána to protect the assets of Bank of Ireland? And where are all these Gardaí when there's people getting beaten up in the streets? That's not a criticism of the Gardaí, because they are instructed to go where they're instructed to go. But that's what jumped out at me. A, why are RTE protecting Bank of Ireland cash machines? I thought that really strange. And B, why should they? You know what I mean? Why should they? But anyway, so what's going to happen this morning is that the Bank of Ireland, if it hasn't happened already, if you took €1,000 out that you didn't have, you're now going to be overdrawn, which there are penalties attached to that. And I see now a rush of people trying to get through to the Bank of Ireland saying, well, I didn't realise what happened and I thought this, that and the other, to try and avoid extra fees. And they're not going to be able to get through because the bank's going to be overwhelmed with calls. So I'd imagine that's tomorrow morning's front story. But anyway, Bank of Ireland is facing a crisis after thousands of customers descended on ATMs yesterday evening, attempting to take advantage of a major IT glitch. The bank notified customers early yesterday afternoon that there was an issue with its online app and personal banking website after being flooded with complaints. And by the evening, customers had detected that they could access cash from ATMs despite having low levels of funds. Gardaí, as I say, were instructed to clear the queues from ATMs. Again, I don't understand why they did that. But anyway, as people lined up to take advantage of the glitch, thousands of people were last night queuing around the block outside some branches to withdraw money that they did not have in their own accounts. So, like, I would be really interested, not to labour the point, as to who instructed the Gardaí. Like, were they concerned there was a public order offence happening? I mean, this was an arrangement between a person, private person, and their bank. Again, I don't see what the role of the Gardaí as a middle person is there. But anyway, did you get money out? Do you regret it? Has the bank told you yet that you have to pay it back? Because you could be forgiven for taking the thousand out if you had no money, going in and spending €300 on a big, big shop, you know what I mean, to feed the family or what have you, and you're left with €700 and you owe the bank €1,000, and it's going to take an awful lot of time and effort to get back into the black again. But as I say, affected by that at all, let us know. 086 60 25,000. So what do RTE do with their money? We know they pay their top staff, as they call them, extraordinary amounts of money, but they also spend your money on things like the Eurovision. So how much did it cost us to send Wild Youth to the Eurovision? €1.3 million. Let me read that to you again. €1.3 million. Cash-strapped RTE forked out more than €1.3 million trying to qualify for the Eurovision Song Contest since 2018. So it's not just last year, but it's still accumulative. It's a lot of money. The station yesterday revealed their latest bill to send Wild Youth to Liverpool to the Song Contest in May, splashing out almost €340,000 in 2 weeks in Liverpool. And the paper can reveal the station splurged €52,000 on 14 people to stay in a hotel. A further €10,000 was spent on food and drink for 14 people, hungry people. Wild Youth failed to qualify for the song contest with their song We Are One and the M&S Arena in Liverpool. So since 2018, €1.3 million. Spent on that. Leo Varadkar's been doing the rounds in the media. He's in the Sun today, pictured smiling. Leo Varadkar admits he struggles to live a normal social life as Taoiseach, but says most people he meets when out are nice. The Fine Gael leader, who's 44, confessed he likes to escape abroad where he can be anonymous, as he sometimes feels like a fish in the fishbowl back home. And in a rare personal interview, Leo Varadkar tells how being a public figure gives way to a very different way of living. He said, "It's nice to get abroad sometimes where there's nobody looking at you or talking about you or whispering, thinking you can't hear them. That's one thing that is sort of an escape when you get abroad. Just to be able to take a taxi or go to the shops without anyone looking in your basket or smart comments, even just someone coming up to you and saying, thank you for doing a great job. That happens a lot. Most people are nice. You wouldn't think that from online, but in the real world, most people are polite and nice. But it's nice being able to escape that from time to time." And him and his partner have pulled back from being as public about their relationship to protect their privacy. It doesn't help either, of course, when there are messages from his partner about attending royal events and all that become revealed, and then it's all controversial, or you get pictured in a nightclub or whatever might happen. The Irish Daily Mirror: RTE's Joe Duffy's accused the Wolf Tones of glorifying slaughter in a war of words on air with the band's frontman. I didn't hear this. I'm not sure I'll listen back to it either, but anyway. Brian Warfield was on Lifeline yesterday after a video circulated on social media of revelers attending the Fela in Belfast, taking part in pro-IRA chanting on Sunday evening. Videos of the concert showed around 10,000 fans chanting "Ooh-ah, up the rah" at the concert in the Falls Park in West Belfast. Warfield, who penned Celtic Symphony, I beg your pardon, in 1987 to celebrate the centenary of Classic Celtic Football Club, said he was a little bit sick of all that this nitpicking the band has received over the years over the particular song. But anyway, this riled Joe Duffy, and they had something of a row, but he invited him on. Maybe he invited him on with both barrels loaded, but anyway, he was his guest on the programme. I didn't hear it, probably won't listen back. 20 past nine, how are you getting on this morning? Get in touch with us again to remind you of the numbers 086 60 25,000, or give us a call on 07491 25,000. Now, around about 2 million live minutes are viewed at the programme and across our social media and website every month, and we really do appreciate you engaging with us that way. 2 million live minutes, so that's people watching live across various platforms, not to mention those that watch back thereafter. Amongst them this morning, Maggie. Good morning, Maggie. In early, she even said good morning to Lee. Rosemary's there, Annie, Beth, and all the rest of you, thank you very much. If you want to watch the show and most of the guests that join us, it's a little bit like a TV show, I suppose you could say. You can do so on YouTube, Highland Radio Ireland. You can watch on your phone, tablet, laptop, your smart TV. As I've said before, most smart TVs, all smart TVs now have the YouTube app. You might as well use it. We're also on your Fire Stick as well. Lots of you have those through the YouTube app. And we're across our Facebook pages, Highland News and Sport, Highland Hub. Now, a listener texted in to say, Greg, can you get someone to explain how it is that you are prescribed Maxilief Sulfadine for long-term pain and the pharmacy doesn't have them in stock yet? They can sell them to you over the counter in the same pharmacy. I'm wondering, is it because I have a medical card? P.S. One chemist is selling a 24-pack for €13, another for €7. How do they explain all that? Well, I mean, let's get an insight into it. And it's not any of Tom's, Tom Murray's pharmacies that listener is referencing, but Tom's good for coming on and maybe giving us an insight. So Tom Murray, Treasurer of the Irish Pharmacy Union and owner of Murray Pharmacies, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg. How are you?
Not too bad at all, Tom. So do you understand where the listener is coming from?
Absolutely. I absolutely understand the frustration that the listener is coming from. And to be honest with you, it's a frustration that the pharmacists share as well. So to be clear, the Sulfadine that is in the dispensary, a 60-pack of Sulfadine, is a prescription-only product that can only be supplied on prescription. And it's currently one of the nearly 300 medicines that there's a shortage of in the country at the moment. It's reimbursed through the HSE, which is at a deal that is done between the government, the HSE, and the drug companies. And it's a different product in the sense that the over-the-counter pack is a smaller pack that's a private sale that the drug companies supply to us that there isn't a shortage of. But certainly Sulfadine and Maxilief and a number of other medicines which have both over-the-counter and prescription-only status, the prescription-only product is currently in shortage in Ireland, and it's part of the 300 medicines that we face daily shortages of that frustrates patients, pharmacists, doctors, nobody more than patients, though.
And pardon my ignorance, what would stop a pharmacist from putting together 60 tablets, in other words, two packs of 24 and another 12 and making up the 60-pack?
Because they are different products in that they're licensed differently and they're reimbursed completely differently. And there is an element of the reimbursement, the 60-pack, which is at a price done by the HSE, is at a much lower price than the drug companies sell us the 24-pack for.
And I think people have to remember, we have to remember, that a pharmacy is a business as well. It's an important part of a community, but it is a business, the same as a butcher's or a newsagent's.
It absolutely is. And the over-the-counter medicine is a private sale between the pharmacy and the customer, just as any other product in any other business is bought and sold. The dispensary pack are supplied through an agreement between the state and the drug companies, of which the pharmacist has absolutely no say in the price of the medicine.
But what is going on here? They are fundamentally the same medicine, though, aren't they, in terms of...
The same medicine.
So are suppliers playing games then, because they can seemingly have enough supply, or maybe there's not as much demand for private sales, but then through these schemes that they have with governments and the health services of governments, there is a supply shortfall. So what do you think is going on there? Because obviously it's patients and you guys that are being caught in the middle of all of this.
Yes, and it's the patients more than anybody, and absolutely the patients are having to wait while we ring doctors and get an alternative medicine, which hopefully can treat the patient's chronic pain, as your listener referred to in their email into you. There are over 300 medicines short in Ireland at the moment, not just in Ireland. It's a European issue. It's a global issue. There is a supply and demand issue where the manufacturers aren't able to come up with global demand coming out of COVID. Most of the basic ingredients for medicines are supplied through China and India. And there is a delay in the production for those, which has led to, as I say, nearly 300 commonly used medicines in short supply. And unfortunately, patients are the ones that are suffering because the drug companies are slow in making that supply. We also have to remember that Ireland is a very, very small market in the global market, and we may not be the first choice for drug companies to supply to when they look at the markets they have in Europe or America or in Britain. Or, you know, it's a lot more profitable for a drug company to supply the population of France than it is to supply the population of the Republic of Ireland.
Am I correct in saying that you believe things might get worse before they improve, at least for some medicines?
I think that the global shortage of medicines is an ongoing and fluctuating problem, and it increases and decreases. But I can foresee that the shortages which we've experienced this year, which has seen the shortages rise to almost 300, I could imagine that that may get worse for commonly used medicines, yes, in the next period of time, because I don't see that the drug companies have managed to keep up with the demand globally, and I do think that the problem may worsen, yes.
During COVID, which you mentioned, we acquired, did we not, vaccines European-wide, and then they were distributed pro rata. Why don't we do similarly with medicines? You know, we are in a union, we are a small country, and maybe if we were able to do it that way, it would work to our advantage.
Well, what Ireland does as a state, it does sit with the within the European average in terms of the price of medicines, and there's a basket of countries which are assessed, and we sit, when the government is setting the reimbursable price of medicines and negotiating with the drug companies, we do sit in the middle of that. But there isn't a pan-European wide medicine purchasing project as of yet. That does not exist within the EU. It did in the global pandemic because it was a different response to a different condition, which had taken the world by surprise. And there was a lot of things that happened in COVID where countries acted together and proved that they could act in unison, but that doesn't exist for the purchase of medicines at the moment.
Is there anything that can change here or needs to change? I mean, are we over-prescribing some of these medicines? I presume that can't be the issue. No one is going into a chemist or being prescribed by the GP, with acute pain or severe pain and trying to get some relief from that unless they actually need it. So I presume that's not an issue. But is there anything that we could be looking at locally that could ease some of these pressures?
There's a lot of questions, and that's a complex question. And there certainly isn't over-prescribing, but I suppose there is an element where if patients are having to wait on long waiting lists for hospital treatment and they're in pain, they're chronically prescribed painkillers whilst they wait on the list. That's one issue, looking at the waiting lists in the hospitals, which you have discussed many of the times. In terms of the other issue, there is a requirement by drug companies to identify and to notify the government and the HPRA, the Health Protection or the Health Products Regulatory Authority, and the HSC about shortages coming up. They are supposed to give 3 months' notice. Currently, they give less than 2 weeks. Sometimes when we go into the pharmacy, we get told that day that a medicine has gone into short supply and can't be obtained. So there is an element where that could be done. There's something that we have called for in the IPU for many years, for a chief pharmaceutical officer who could work within the Department of Health at the strategy around medicine purchasing and medicine supply into the state, and would be able to produce or provide a bit of leverage and a bit of power from the government into that sector for medicine supply and shortages into the country.
And just finally, to their point that one chemist is selling a medicine cheaper than the other, again, that's a private sale. For whatever reason, I might choose to do that. In terms
no
of over-the-counter, that's just saying, well, why is a loaf of bread 80 cent here and 2.20 there? I mean, that's just up to them to make those decisions.
Exactly. It's a private business transaction. It's why is a pint of Guinness 5 euros in Remelton and it's 7.80 or 8 euros in Dublin? They're private transactions, and it's up to the... the individual business for what for how they price those things. There's absolutely no way that pharmacists could sit down and agree pricing. That would be completely illegal, and we wouldn't want to see that happen. So it's just a private individual market.
And just members of the union, Irish Pharmacy Union, like, how are they coping? This is a difficult working environment. It's ongoing. You know, I know there's good cooperation between various pharmacies to, you know, help out if there's supply in one place and not in the other. But in terms of just operating a business, I mean, is there a tipping point here of frustration, or are they just going to keep their heads down and soldier through, so to speak?
There is certainly a tipping point, and in a survey that we did from on the Irish Pharmacy Union on behalf of our members and pharmacists, employees and owners throughout the country, we found that over 90% of them are experiencing burnout and stress. So there is a tipping point, and there is a point where the system balances very, very finely between productivity and falling apart. In terms of Donegal, I will say that one thing we do have is we have a fantastically collegiate pharmacy practice. So we have a WhatsApp group with all the pharmacists in Donegal, all the pharmacies in Donegal on it. So if I'm short of a medicine and you came in looking for a medicine this morning, as has happened to me many a time lately, I can put up into our WhatsApp group, hi, does anybody have this medicine? Where are you located? And then it's either I can ask the patient to travel there and go to another pharmacy, or if they can't do that, there have been times when I have gone in the evening out of hours to collect medicine from another pharmacy and bring it back. And all the pharmacists in Donegal do that. As you said at the top of the interview, we are very, very central to the community, and we take that role very, very seriously. And pharmacists love living and working in their own communities. Mm-hmm. That's why we're called community pharmacy. And we're really lucky that in Donegal, we have a very collegiate attitude between the pharmacies in Donegal.
Yeah, before I let you go, this came in yesterday and came in again today, because we've spoken in the past about, you know, pharmacies having maybe a little bit more discretion to replace one medicine with a similarly acting medicine. But to this person's text, when our GP writes out a prescription, and when you go to the chemist, they sometimes give you a cheaper version of the doctor's prescription. Why is this? Why do we not get what is written on the prescription? Now, I mean, there are generic brands of stuff as well, and sometimes you'll get a different brand of the same product 3 or 4 months in a row.
Okay, you've hit the nail on the head there. There are a number of medicines which are called reference price medicines, where the state has set the maximum price or the only price that they'll reimburse for, and very often that's not the proprietary brand. The proprietary brand may be more expensive, so the pharmacist is obliged to provide a generic, and that's what we do. We provide the product that the state will reimburse for, and that's not a uniquely Irish thing. That is a global phenomenon. Generic medicines are all over the world.
Okay.
And that's a cost saving. And in fairness to the Irish state, they have done a good job in reducing the ongoing rising costs of medicines over the last 10 to 15 years. The Irish state has been very aggressive in its reduction of costs of medicines, and that will continue, because we all know what the spend on health is in this country, and that's probably not sustainable either. So it's all part of a complex issue, but that's the choices.
Well, Tom, at 9:34, I was handed a note saying that you needed to be gone by 9:30. So.
Okay, yeah, well, actually, I'm going into a meeting with the Department of Health, so I do have to go.
I know, sorry, that's it. All right, thanks, Tom. Tom Murray, Treasurer of the Irish Pharmacy Union and owner of Murray Pharmacy. So hopefully that answers, maybe not to your satisfaction, but certainly answers those queries as they came in there. Right, the Irish postal system is now a major route for illegal and fake prescription drugs coming into this country, as more people use social media and websites to buy everything from strong painkillers and sedatives to erectile dysfunction tablets. There is a warning that people with addiction are increasingly at risk of fatal overdose by using black market prescription drugs to supplement heroin too. Professor Colin O'Gara is a consultant psychiatrist at St. John of God Hospital. He joins us now, and thank you so much for your time this morning, Professor. How are you keeping?
Very well, thanks very much. Good to be on with you. Thanks very much.
Right, okay. I mean, there are obviously tight regulations around the use of medication, as we were just before we were joined by you speaking to a pharmacist by coincidence. But people are circumnavigating that quite easily?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, prior to COVID, there was, to be fair, an issue in terms of, you know, once the smartphone came along, really, there was And I suppose the development of the internet in general, broadband, you saw sites developing around, I suppose, around the world, basically. And what we've seen is a general increase in the sophistication of those sites online, and also the amount of drugs that are coming through the, well, it's essentially the internet, but it becomes the last piece of that is the postal system. So, yeah, I mean, definitely concerning prior to COVID, but once COVID hit then, we all kind of went online, and there were a lot of restrictions then in terms of being able to go out because of the lockdowns. And actually, you know, get your hands on drugs from that route. So certainly it increased. Yeah, the online piece is very important then.
Yeah, I mean, because obviously people's addictions didn't pause. People's wish to make money off their backs didn't pause. So really that drove probably improvements, if I could put it like that, in an online network. You know, the same as local shops started to say, right, we need to be able to do some of our operations online. Those involved in this this type of activity also would have had to have found ways to maintain their addictions or their income.
Absolutely. And I suppose what's striking for those of us working in clinical services at the moment is the, you know, the ongoing commercialization and the ability of those who are selling drugs to make the product more attractive and to normalize it in many ways. I mean, we've seen this for decades with cocaine, but in terms of the normalization of the selling of the product, you have WhatsApp messages going out with menus, you know, produced in almost, you know, a way that you'd associate with, you know, retail outlets, and listing the kind of drugs that are available. Obviously, young people, when they get this, it does add a layer of, well, this has got to be okay on some level. I mean, we saw this with ecstasy pills all the way back to the early 90s. Where the pills were always stamped with, say, a commercial entity like McDonald's or Mitsubishi or whatever. So again, these are the methods used to normalize the drug use, and online space has been developing all the time. Mm-hmm. And as you know, I suppose the last piece of that is just the postal service, where, I mean, there's all kinds of methods being used over the years in terms of getting the drugs through. A lot of the drugs we're talking about are very small. Traditionally, it would be hallucinogens, would be, you know, acid in particular would be, you know, printed on paper and very easy to distribute. More recently, the deadly drug fentanyl, which is an opioid drug, is very small as well and is causing havoc in the United States in terms of deaths. So, I mean, the transportation, if the drug is small, it makes it a lot easier. And a lot of the postal route, I suspect, is dominated by small amounts of powder that can be transported to individual users. You're not transporting a large amount. So it suits quite well that it can be, you know, it can be transported. And our custom colleagues, I guess, are, you know, like, it's very difficult, I suspect, to if it's coming in volume like that in small amounts, but very high frequency, very difficult to intercept.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, even recently I got a delivery from Amazon and it was like Russian dolls. It was a tiny little bowl within a box, within a box, within a big box. And you're just thinking, you know, you put a million of those over a period of time. How do you decipher what's in them or not? And I'll get back to the postal side of things, and this is slightly different, though. Like, we were talking recently to a counsellor in this on this program, and he talked of how it's as easy to get cocaine in Donegal and the Northwest now as it might be a pizza. And after that, someone sent me a video of how they, through Snapchat, within seconds, had made an arrangement to go and get coke. piece of cake in their local area. But that's not specifically what we're talking about today. And I think sometimes, Professor, as we were speaking, people might be imagining in their mind the type of person that they might sort of think we're talking about here. But in your experience, you're coming across people from all different backgrounds, all different classes or social statuses, in inverted commas, that are all availing of these postal services to maintain and worsen their habits.
Yeah, I mean, it's the demographic is really striking, I guess. I mean, the traditionally we'd associate stimulant use, particularly cocaine at the moment, with perhaps a younger age group. And what we're seeing is people basically in their 50s and 60s who haven't had a history of maybe using drugs earlier in their life, taking up drug use at this age. And you got to ask, well, what's the situation there? How does that happen? And what we're told is that it's a lot of it is to do with pubs, you know, and rural pubs in particular, that were never associated with drug use. I mean, if you go back a few decades, you'd have identified pubs in cities where drug use would take place. And most people knew, well, that was a drug pub, or that was, you know what I mean? There was the people in there would be taking drugs, and they were few and far between, to be fair. But what we have now is a situation where basically there isn't a pub in the country at this stage, I would argue, certainly from what I'm told. I mean, like places where, like very rural places where traditionally there was just, you know, alcohol and tobacco smoking, obviously. But now you have maybe you'd start off with a group, maybe younger group using cocaine, and then an older group would say, well, you might have an individual there who hasn't been doing well, maybe suffering depression, going through a difficult time. And they'd say, well, look, I might try some of that. And these are the kind of stories that were told in terms of how an older age group might start, you know. But it all comes down to the availability. The more available a drug is, the more end harm you're going to have. And essentially, obviously, you're going to have more people introduced to it.
Yeah, and it's all in different levels as well. You have people that will go from chemist to chemist getting strong painkillers to satisfy an addiction that they have. It's on all different levels. So what do we do, Professor? Because there's two things going on here. There is the demand, which seems to be increasing, like lots of people seemingly taking illicit or illegal drugs. And then we have sort of the way they're coming into the country. I mean, Firstly, you want to get to the root cause of the problem. Say, you know, why is that person that you talk of feeling so lost that they feel they have to go down this route of addiction? Or is it, you know, we need to invest more? But I mean, I just can't help but feel that if we were to crack down on moving this stuff through the post, that the people will find a different way to do it, if you know what I mean. So what do you think, as a professional working in this area, we need to do and to try and stop this spiral we seem to be in?
Yeah, I mean, you've hit all the good points there, really. In terms of the way we'd look at it, is the situation clearly isn't working at the moment. I mean, when you have such high availability, whatever has happened to date is broken. And I don't think anybody can argue against that. I mean, I think we need to look at why people take drugs. I mean, a lot of people take drugs without a difficulty, and we have to be open to that idea. We have to acknowledge that. But there's a lot of people that take drugs as a coping mechanism for the treatment of pain, emotional pain, physical pain, various kinds of trauma. Maybe their psychiatric medication isn't optimal and isn't working. So really what we've got to do, in my view, is it all comes down to, are we going to put in funding, and are we going to really fund proper services where if you do come across somebody who's using drugs, can we, you know, persuade people in that situation to do something that might be less harmful to their physical and mental health, and something that would be better for their overall well-being.
Yeah, so I speak to you professionals like you who work at the coalface and see, you know, between people like yourself, counsellors and others, who see what's happening in this country and express concerns. But then, you know, things like vapes, cannabis, cocaine, widely used amongst young people. There doesn't seem to be any organised public information campaign from those that perhaps are responsible for it to discourage it. You know, we've dragged our feet so much on the vapes, it's embarrassing. Cannabis, the message out there is, well, depending on who you listen to, it's not too bad at all. And, you know, cocaine is cheaper than drink, it's handy, God won't kill you. I'm not saying that those are the cases, but if you're 18, 19, 16, 17, that maybe that's the message you're hearing. There seems to be no alternative narrative or no drive to sort of try and change people's minds. You know, we're talking about the problems and the outcomes and all that kind of stuff, but where is the messaging and information to say, you know, this is what you're doing to yourself potentially?
Yeah, well, it's lost. It needs to be two-sided, you know. It needs to have the harm piece, which along the lines of, it was called Talk to Frank, a campaign in the UK. It was probably about 20 years ago at this stage. But it was a very highly effective, sophisticated campaign in terms of the harms of in particular, cocaine. We do have to present that. We have to present the stroke deaths. We have to present the cardiovascular deaths. In fact, there's a piece in the paper today about, it was in the Irish Times today, about, and it quotes a doctor from the Mater Hospital in Dublin talking about the complications that drug users get from a cardiac point of view. But you're dead right. That part of it gets lost. But also the other part of it is, you know, that a lot of people do take drugs without a difficulty. So there's a two-sided piece to this, and all the information needs to get out there so that people get an informed, they get information which is relevant, which is evidence-based and is properly informed and isn't slanted in a particular direction. And then for those people who do want to move away, or perhaps people who are caught in the criminal justice system, that they're diverted into, they're not stigmatized, number one, and number two, that they're treated compassionately, and those who are motivated to move away are helped to do so. All of that takes great funding. And to date, particularly the last two decades in this country, mental health and addiction service funding has been completely insufficient. And I, you know, guess as a first step, that's it. But of course, there's so many other competing interests in medicine in particular. And that's the challenge. How do we get the funding to it, you know?
Yeah, we'd need another 3 hours for that one. Okay, listen, Professor Colin O'Gara, thank you so much for all your time this morning.
Thanks so much.
Have a lovely day. He's consultant psychiatrist at St. John of God Hospital. Any views on that? 086 60 25000 WhatsApps or text, or give us a call on 074 91 25000. Yesterday, we were speaking to a lady from Dublin who was up visiting in Donegal, and she had her cockapoo, I think it's called, out for a walk on the beach. And another lady who had her Alsatian stroke German Shepherd with her. And the Alsatian stroke German Shepherd went for the cockapoo, I think it's called, again, and attacked it. The dog seems to be okay. It got veterinary treatment. But anyway, from that, we got contact from the Cathaoirleach of the Glenties Municipal District, Councillor Michael McClafferty, who has views on this. Good morning, Councillor. How are you getting on?
Good morning, Greg. How's things?
Good, good, good. Right, okay. So what's your view then as it relates to... is it dangerous dogs specifically, I suppose? And I suppose, how do you categorise those?
Well, I suppose the thing is, Greg, to be fair, with the German Shepherds, Alsatians, / Doberman, / Rottweiler, they're grand dogs as such when they're okay. But the problem is with these three particular dogs that I'm aware of anyway, and I say that because of my own experience as well of being attacked, they can just change the click of your fingers. Like, that is the problem, Greg. You can have them for years and years, lovely pets, whatever, possibly around kids and so on, as they do be. But unfortunately, for whatever reason, some day or some night, something can just snap in their mind and they will just go for you.
Yeah, I would never trust a dog, to be honest with you, because I've seen them. I've seen a dog turn. What was your experience? You were attacked by a dog.
I was attacked by an Alsatian, notably three times, to be fair, but the third time was almost fatal. And I suppose the third time, to be fair, with the Alsatian in question, I would have been killed that night, Greg, all to death, only for my employer at the time. His son happened to be close by and was able to save me. Mm-hmm. But if he wasn't there that night, as I say, I would have been mauled to death. There was no question about it. The Alsatian had me, first of all, Alsatian had broken his chain. He broke his chain in the process of diving in the air, if you like. You see it there sometimes on the internet or whatever, you know, whether it be a fox or whatever diving for a bird or something like that, or a wolf diving for something. But anyway, you can imagine when I leaping in the air, front legs out, just leaping in the air, and I was actually facing him when he leaped. I turned round as he was leaping, and the first place his two front legs landed on my shoulders, a leg in his shoulder, and he tumbled me to the ground. So in the process of him tumbling me to the ground, Greg, first thing I initially done, I suppose instinct kicks in, I grabbed his neck, around his head, if you like, because I knew if I didn't, he was going to tear the face off me. So he did proceed in tearing basically from my neck right down, all my clothes and that, for the few seconds or maybe slightly longer that he got away, until my employer's son at the time.
Were you surprised by the power of the dog?
I wasn't surprised by the power of him, because obviously I knew he was a big dog. Like any big dog, you know, you need to respect they are powerful, clearly. I was surprised now that he broke the chain, because quite a strong chain was on him, but nonetheless, he managed to break it. He managed to break it out of rage, whatever, anger. Anger to get at me, possibly, but he done that anyway, and he done it comfortably, to be fair, my dad. So yeah, that is my experience. And
really, in a nutshell, because we don't have a ton of time between the stories we've heard, your experiences, and a general common knowledge, you believe that the likes of the Alsatian or Rottweilers, they should never be off a lead and never be walked without a muzzle.
No, in public, yes, Greg, they shouldn't be off lead and muzzle as well. Yes, definitely. When you're a public place like beaches, parks, etc., the likes of that lady the last day, there is no point going down to the beach with any of these dogs or the park or wherever, and a built up area, even through a town or such, where they'll be occasionally, you see them from time to time. You cannot take that chance or that risk.
And I think people still don't realise, as nice as this lady, and I'm not, the lady's anonymous, okay, so we're not jumping on any individual person, but that they're lovely, friendly Alsatian bounding around the beach. If I walked down there with my toddler, he would scream the house down. He's got a fear of dogs, don't know where it came from. I would have to leave. Do you know what I mean? So that cute experience that they're having, and it's a lovely little animal that won't hurt anyone, there are people simply would have to leave the beach because of a fear of the dog being out of control. And by out of control, I mean not being on a lead.
Yeah, well, of course, all dogs at all times should be on a lead / muzzles in public area.
Okay.
And I think as well, to prepare Greg as well, people need to realise as well, when you go into the public area, particularly the beach and that, for the likes of yourself landing with a wee fellow there, you need to respect that as well. You can go down early in the morning, you go down late at night, you don't need to be there at family-oriented times or such with your dog. You know, and I think a wee bit of respect and appreciation on both sides, you know, we'll go a long way too, as well, with the dog owners.
Just all right. Thank you so much for your time. I really do appreciate it, and we'll chat again
soon.
Thank you, Greg. And I'm glad I didn't realise you had that experience. Not nice at all. Okay, take care of yourself. That is Councillor Michael McClafferty, Cathaoirleach of the Glenties Municipal District. Okay, you are tuned to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. Coming up, we have the second hour of the show, of course. That's after the news and obituary notices. Stay right where you are.